On the Empire Podcast this week, we take a little trip through time to talk Pompeii with Tom Hiddleston. All that and the usual movie news, reviews, and nonsense on the movie podcast that is ready, willing, and potentially able to spend $100 million of Elon Musk's money making a historically accurate version of the Odyssey. We will be making it with historically accurate giants and monsters, but it will be happening. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and I'll be hosting this week. Your regular host, Chris Hewitt, has selflessly stepped aside to give me another go with no thought for his own interest or well-being. Say, where is Chris right now anyway?
So, just to be clear, Chris went to Pompeii, where he was tracked down by Tom Hiddleston, presumably because he was hiding in apocalypses. And so Loki had to basically seize him and bring him back to the TVA.
Yes, but now where is he? He's gone to...
I can only assume in another apocalypse. Maybe he's gone to one of the other great disasters of our times, and that's where he's going to be editing the podcast.
I guess so. Well, he isn't here anyway, and hopefully he'll bring us back some exclusive merch from
the apocalypse that is the San Diego Comic-Con. Yeah.
Yes, but fear not. As you heard, I'm not alone. I'm joined by... Well, let's say two colleagues of such lethal cunning.
Yeah.
One is currently waylaid by an interview with a famous movie baddie.
Yeah.
But with me already is the mad titan of movies himself, James Dyer. How are you?
I'm good. In fact, I have just got off the phone with a personage of note myself.
Yes.
And run down to the studio after my interview.
One of your favourite people.
One of my favourite ever people.
Yeah.
Yes. It was very exciting, and I'm still quite squee. So if I'm bouncing off the walls, that's the reason why.
That's unusual for you.
Yeah,
so
thank you.
Maybe you'll stay awake through the interview section.
I promise nothing.
We will also be joined by someone else, but I'll just leave the suspense,
tension. It could be anyone.
It could
literally be anyone. It's a mon. But yes, he will be down once his interview is finished.
Absolutely.
So he will join us.
He will. In the meantime, let's try and see if we can have a question. So this came from John Brainy on Instagram.
That's a great name.
Isn't that good? Nolan said that The Odyssey was the best dog movie. What are the Empire team's best dog movies? Aww.
This is tricky because I feel like we have an obligation to not be wrong. It also feels like what you're asking, Helen, I hate to say it, is almost a Mount Rushmore of dogs.
Oh,
and,
no.
But we can't do that.
No, because they're all good boys.
Because they're all good boys and girls.
And girls.
But also because I think Chris would riot if we did a dog Rushmore without him.
I mean, that's almost a reason to do it. But no, Chris, we wouldn't do that.
We would never do that. We would never create a Mount Rushmore with Bruiser from Legally Blonde in Pride of Place in the middle. We would never do that.
You think Bruiser makes it to that list?
You don't think so?
I have met a cute Chihuahua.
Right.
But most of them, not cute.
I know. They're cute because they're small.
Yeah, but they're not
but
cute.
They're not cute, cute.
No.
No. What about Einstein? You mentioned Back to the Future. Would he be on that?
Oh, he's a good dog.
He is a good dog.
I don't know that he does very much. I feel like we should probably be prioritizing the dogs that have more of a role in proceedings.
Okay.
Einstein doesn't really do much traveling back to or from the future.
Yeah, okay, that is true. And John Wick's dog doesn't have a name that I'm aware of.
The second dog, no.
No. Does the first dog have a name?
Isn't it Daisy?
Sure. Yes, it is. Daisy. Daisy the dog. Daisy just gets fridged, though, so that's maybe not.
Oh, yeah, but Daisy's cute.
Daisy is very cute.
Really cute. Second dog, less cute, but
more
alive.
Mm. Yeah, more alive than Daisy. Yeah, definitely has a pulse.
I mean, speaking of Wick, I mean, what about Halle Berry's dogs?
Oh, yeah, she's got that little pack of Dobermans.
Yeah, and they're really well trained.
Yeah, they run up walls and stuff.
Yeah.
They're like bullet time dogs. That's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. I also once met one of the Dobermans... Maybe both of the Dobermans who were in Hugo.
Dober's Men.
Who were in Hugo, the Martin Scorsese film Hugo.
Really?
Yes. And they were lovely dogs. They came to an Empire event and up close and personal, again, hadn't ever been a Doberman person, didn't see the attraction. Up close and personal, those were beautiful, very friendly, very likable dogs. And crucially, for my love of them, their trainer told me that when you see them barking like mad and looking very scary and threatening on the movie, that is because the trainer is standing behind the camera wiggling a ball on a little piece of string.
And they're just losing their shit over it.
And they're losing their shit over that. And that makes them so much more lovable than when I thought they were going to kill someone.
Yeah, that's fair. Oh, that's very cool. I think genuinely one of the best dogs I have ever met in person was Henry Cavill's dog, Kal-El. who...
You met Cavill.
Yeah, so when I interviewed Cavill, it must have been just off the pandemic, and he wouldn't let me shake his hand because, you know, he didn't want to get COVID from me. But he said I was the bridge between us could be Cal. So I was allowed to hug Cal the dog, and he's a giant Akita, and he is just a big ball of fluff, and he's glorious.
If you've seen Henry Cavill's Instagram, this is the reason to follow Henry Cavill's Instagram. It's not the topless shirts of him working out. It's his dog. His dog is actually the dog equivalent of topless shots of Henry Cavill working out. Like, it's a beautiful dog.
Stunning.
It
absolutely
really
stunning.
Is. That's a good... But he's not in the movie.
He's not in the movie, so would not count for... Were we to do a Mount Rushmore, a dog Rushmore, which we're not doing, crucially, because we wouldn't do that to Chris, but were we to... Cal would not be on it.
No.
Baxter would be on Chris's, I suspect. Baxter from Anchorman.
Yes.
If you can find him after he was kicked off the bridge.
He can eat a whole wheel of cheese.
Mm. I mean,
he's a very impressive dog. And he speaks Spanish. I think the 101 Dalmatians, either live action or cartoon, make a pretty good case. Also cartoon rather than live action, Lady and the Tramp. Both really
I don't
dogs.
Think you can have a cartoon dog.
I don't see why. They're all good dogs.
I mean...
I think one of my favourite live-action films about dogs, although I have trouble picking a specific dog in it, is Best in Show. That's a great dogs movie.
It is
but
a
not,
good dogs
there's
movie.
No particular standout hero dog, you know? So does it lose points for that?
I mean, for the sake of this question, and not a dog Rushmore, and I'm pretty sure we've actually done a dog Rushmore in the past, but if we're doing dog movies, so movies about dogs, I mean, weirdly, the first ones that spring to mind for, I don't really understand reason, would be the James Belushi movie, K-9, and Turner and Hooch.
I knew you were going to say Turner and Hooch at some point. I knew as soon as I mentioned this question.
I don't know why those are the first things I think of.
Because it's your era of when you were watching movies.
Yeah, I think that probably has a lot to do with it, yeah.
I feel like we should clarify that as people raised in the UK and Ireland, we have not been subjected to, like, Old Yeller in the way that Americans have. I believe they have adopted that to their hearts. And even, like, Homeward Bound was not that big a deal here. It was in my local video store. I have seen it. But it's not, like, on regular rotation in the way that I think it was for a long time in the States.
Yeah.
So I just want to make that clear. We're not ignoring them. We just don't care about your culture.
All right, hear me out. Cujo.
I hear you. I don't know that... I feel like he might be the exception to the they're all good dogs.
It is a good dog movie. So technically...
No, but we just discussed that it has to be about the dog.
I mean, it's a good movie with a dog.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You were here like a second ago when we discussed it.
Because like Lassie is objectively a good dog, but I don't think I would call them good films about a dog.
No, I would agree with that.
No, I say films. Are there multiple films? There's Lassie, Revenge of Lassie, Lassie Goes Bananas, Lassie Boogaloo...
Son of Lassie.
Lassies with a dollar sign.
With a dollar sign, I Am Legend.
I Am Legend.
I think that's...
What's the dog's name in I Am Legend?
Hang on.
You're literally Googling what is the dog's name in I Am Legend, aren't you?
I am. Sam is the dog.
Sam. Who can forget Sam?
Well, that's my point. I remember the dog. Sam is not the best dog name in movies. I'll give you that.
No, I don't think it is. It's not memorable. Dog. But I do like dogs with human names.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when people call dogs nouns, I like it's like, are you going to shout, you know, like banister or, you know, like whatever you call it, golf ball. These are probably not names you'd give a dog, but you know what I mean. Like, I feel like shouting a name feels less weird than shouting just a word.
Okay, so you just want like human names for dogs.
Or Kryptonian names. Kal-El is fine.
Kal-El is good, yes. I think geek names for dogs obviously would be my go-to. There's lots of Lokis out there.
Yes.
And things like that.
Denethor, come to me!
Would you want a dog called Denethor? He'd be a really messy eater and kind of a downer to have around.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
And you wouldn't trust him with puppies.
No. Or, you know, high buildings.
No. Just no to Denethor as a dog name. Sorry.
No to Denethor as a dog.
That's a hard pass.
No to self.
What about Marley?
Marley and me. I don't think I ever saw Marley and Me.
Well... Spoiler, it doesn't end well.
dog films, it rarely ends well for the dog.
That's true, and it's very upsetting that that's the case. I don't like it. I'm not here for it. I think that might be why we haven't sought out some of those old yellers and things.
Yeah.
Because who wants to watch the dog die at the end? you know, a spoiler there anyway. But Turner and Hooch, I mean, there's a lot of dribble is the problem.
There is a lot of dribble.
And it's the same with Beethoven.
Yes, and there are multiple Beethovens as well.
There are.
I'd love a St. Bernard. They're massive, and I appreciate that.
I do, yeah. I mean, again, credit where it's due. What was the one about the sleigh dog who has to get back across the mountain?
Oh, it's called like Pogo or Togo or...
Togo.
Is it Togo?
I think it's Togo.
It's something like that, isn't it? It's two syllables. It's you know.
That was a really good dog.
A very good dog. I love a husky. Huskies are actually my favourite breed of dog.
Huskies are good dogs. I mean, they're all good dogs.
They're all good dogs.
I don't know that we're narrowing it down
Not
to
really.
The best movie
Okay,
dogs.
Right. We have decided that in the same way as with dogs, they are all good films.
Yes, I think
because
so.
They feature dogs.
Indeed. I feel like it's, although some of them are not good films, but the dogs are good dogs.
They're all good dogs in films that may or may not be good films.
Yes, so we're just going with Hooch.
Sure.
All right, and of course, Argos in Not the Shop in The Odyssey as well.
Yes.
Who clings to life.
Oh.
Now, this is not a spoiler. A, this is in the poem, which is 3,000 years old. And B, it's just not a spoiler. I'm sorry, this will not spoil your experience of the film. Argos holds to life, clings to life for more than 20 years while Odysseus is away, waiting for his master to return. You don't need to know any more than that. That is not a spoiler. That is a fact of historical myth, okay? Argos clings to life for 20 years plus. That's a good dog.
That is a very good dog.
Maybe we just call him the best
Maybe
dog.
Maybe the best dog.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right, Christopher Nolan, you got what you wanted, damn it. And hello to Charlie, your dog. Please give him a scritch on our behalf. All right, another quick question while we wait for Amon. Which classical or ancient myth or story should be adapted next? Could there be an Aeneid film? Is there a Jason and the Argonauts due for a remake? This comes from Daniel Watkins. What do you think, James?
This is a good one because a lot of films, a lot of stories have kind of invoked the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, haven't they? Like there's a lot of that in Reminiscence. I believe there's a lot in Sandman as well, isn't there?
Yes, it is, yeah.
So I think that gets layered into things. So I don't think we've had a direct adaptation of it.
Hades Town on stage.
Oh, is that?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, good to know. Haven't seen it.
Okay.
But, okay, fine. So maybe we could adapt that. I've always had a bit of a soft spot for Theseus and the Minotaur.
Ooh.
Just the idea with the labyrinth and things. I mean, is there enough there narratively for a film? Maybe not. Like, I don't know, like just wandering around in a maze for 90 minutes and then getting
a cowman.
Right. It's possible that it needs a little more to it than that, but I always loved that particular myth.
That's a cool myth.
Mm.
The one I want is the one I've talked about before, and it's Irish mythology, and it's the Toyne or the cattle raid of Cooley. And it's a very cool, cool story about how Cuchulainn, who's kind of the Irish Achilles, if you will, has to single-handedly fight an army made up of the three provinces of Ireland that aren't Ulster. So Leinster, Munster and Connaught team up under
the
Queen
people,
Maeve of Connaught. The fighting men of the three provinces, you know, team up to raid Ulster because they want this particular cow. And Ulster says no because we're good at that. And then basically there's a curse that means that almost all the fighting men of Ulster are incapacitated for 7 days. And Cuchulainn has to single-handedly hold this army back while that curse, you know, holds everybody else basically in
Leonidas style, just like...
Yeah, but like...
This is Ireland!
300 times tougher than Leonidas. And also he's a teenager. But he's just like the hardest man in Ireland. It's an incredible story. It is genuinely epic. It has all these sort of like star-crossed, at least besties, if not lovers. And, basically because the Queen of Connaught knows her shit, she sends like his best friend against him. She sends his adopted father against him.
Gosh.
And he has to defeat them all in single combat and all this kind of stuff. The goddess of war like turns into an eel and tries to trip him and stuff. Like all this shit is going down and it is awesome. And they should make it. And I don't understand with 30 million Americans who claim Irish ancestry, why we're not digging into this.
Yeah, why? You don't hear a lot about Irish mythology in, you know, modern media, do you? So,
my personal theory is it's because all the people who moved to America only remembered the trauma of famine, and that's what they passed down. But I think it is a wild missed goal. And I think if you look at the amount of Scottish mythology that gets talked about in American media, given that Scotland has, you know, I would personally say no more mythology than Ireland, if not less, it is baffling to me that it hasn't been more exploited. But I do think it might be sort of traumatic racial memories.
Yeah, perhaps it's that. That sounds like a good choice. That's better than mine. I mean, I would suggest the story of Pandora's box, except, you know, for people who don't know, that's where Pandora opens this forbidden, I think it's actually a jar, isn't it? Pandora's jar just doesn't have the same ring to it. Anyway, and she opens it and unleashes all the miseries of the world on humanity. Unfortunately, that's already been done, because at least two of the films we're reviewing today have in fact released all the miseries of the world. So, you know, that's kind of, that is covered. That box is ticked.
But at least you're not being dramatic about
no,
it.
No, so and this is, I was going to get onto this but when Amon got here, but he's clearly not coming. So I genuinely believe this is a momentous week because it heralds the death knell of cinema. And that is because, and look, I get it, The Odyssey came out, everyone else is still running scared of its monstrous box office, but no one deserves the releases this week. No one.
Okay, but I would put it to you that these are the kind of releases on digital and streaming that we sometimes don't cover because there are better films to talk about. And that the only reason we're covering them this week is that there are no better films to talk about. And that maybe this is not a particular low point in cinema history, but simply the background noise from which the gold rises. Gold doesn't rise. You hear me. Like, we're panning for gold and we're usually finding some nuggets, but we find such a big nugget last week that we've used up all the gold. All the gold.
So what we've just got left is the shit at the bottom of the
I was going to say pebbles, James. I was going to say pebbles,
dirt,
not shit.
Silt, diluvium.
But yes, that stuff is what we're finding right now.
Yeah. But, you know, look forward to the review section. That's going to be fun.
It's going to be great. I mean, and look, hey, it could have been worse. We are not reviewing Water Park Sharks, which is a film that exists in the world I discovered this week. And if I had discovered it earlier, we might be reviewing it.
Oh, my God. It could have been a shark week, a literal shark week, where we just do shark films.
We could have jumped the shark
We have jumped the shark.
Well, look, we've got a slow couple of weeks coming up still, so still happen.
Hey, look, I'm on holiday next week, so I'm just going to leave you to it. Although that does mean I'm missing Spidey.
You are. Mm. Oh, no.
I'm quite disappointed about
that. Will you do without a film starring Tom Holland, Zendaya, and John Bernthal?
I don't know. It's going to feel weird.
It's going to be tough.
It's going to feel very weird.
Wow. Anyway.
Okay.
All right. As we finish that question, through the magic of editing, Amon has arrived.
Da, 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 da.
How
Hello.
Are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How
you have you? A theme tune now.
I can have a theme tune if I want.
I need a theme tune.
Oh, no.
With a church organ, like Interstellar, like, you know,
oh,
like.
Oh, God, we've just
really
gotten
loud.
Calmed down about the nickname, and you've started this now.
I need a theme tune.
Talk about theme tunes. I've been listening to Ludwig Göransson's The Odyssey score ad nauseum, and might be characterized as being very on brand, but my goodness, that score is incredible.
It is incredible. I mean, Hans Zimmer's really going to have to pull it out of the bag not to even challenge for score come December. I don't know what else is on the horizon for the Oscar next year, but right now it feels like a lock.
I put it to you, I think Ludwig is on the best four-movie run for a composer in the modern era right now.
Define modern, because John Williams is still here.
I know, but to go from Oppenheimer, which he won the Oscar for, to Sinners, which he won the Oscar for, to The Mandalorian and Grogu, which is not a great film, but the score is the best thing about that film.
The score is good.
I have notes.
The score is the best thing about that film.
That was leaning on earlier work, so I don't know if we can count that. But like, John Williams did Schindler's List and Jurassic Park in a year.
Yeah.
Star Wars and Superman, and like, they don't even come from. Like, I love Göransson's work. He's incredible.
I am talking about four movies back to back to back to back to back. I have researched this, and I've seen all the John Williams thing, and believe me, John Williams, he's a goat for a reason. Like, he's had multiple things like that across multiple decades, which is just incredible. But in terms of a back-to-back-to-back-to-back run in the modern era, and then he's got The Odyssey, which he's probably going to win the Oscar for in a few months. Like, that is insane. The man is cooking.
For so many reasons, I'm disqualifying you for The Mandalorian and Grogu, because it is building, as Helen said, on original work, and also, it's fine.
The score for that film is incredible.
The score is good, but it's not, like,
Shikari was one of the best songs.
I really like Shikari, actually. I'm not going
to... You see what he's done? He's come in here, he's derailed the podcast.
Shikari. Anyway, there is a hips don't lie joke there somewhere. I think we should get on with the questions.
Yes. Hit us with another question.
Because I do have a couple more questions that I thought I would save for Amon being here because I thought he would enjoy this. And this is the most Amon question that has ever Amon. It comes from Bella Madge on Instagram. Hey. And in light of the Avengers Doomsday trailer, and of course we have a whole reaction pod to that up on the Empire Plus channel.
Literally over an hour.
It got a little out of hand. I'm not sure what happened.
I was told.
It was going to be a tight 20. Yeah, That's how it started.
Mistakes were made.
Anyway, in light of the Avengers Doomsday trailer, which outlandish Doomsday fan theory do you have that you really hope comes true? Now, I came up with a theory about an hour after we recorded that I think I've now decided is true. And that is that the shot we see of Steve in this trailer is not Steve, it's Loki.
I saw that you posted this.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have no reason for thinking this.
He wouldn't be able to take Mjolnir if he were Loki.
He would, because now he is worthy. Mm-hmm. Post-Loki season 2, Loki is worthy. And that, I have decided, is headcanon. That's not changing.
Here's a weird thing. And I think I know, in fact, I know this is just me. When I first saw Cap in that shot, I thought he had a prosthetic nose on. I don't know why. For whatever reason, I was like, is that America's nose? I'm not sure it is.
I'm just saying my theory explains why his hair isn't as full and bouncy as normal. Yes. My theory explains that little smile. I just think it's possible, all right? I think it's possible. What outlandish fan theories or Amon guarantees do you have, Amon?
I have a theory.
It could be Bernie's.
I was just thinking about how to make this film different from Infinity War. Mm. What if in the final moments of Doomsday, where things are at their most desperate, where decisions have to be made about which universe survives and which don't, what if the remaining heroes let Doom create Battleworld? In order to survive. That could be, I think, a thing that ends the film.
Ooh.
I don't think they'll call it Battleworld. I feel that's maybe a bit on the nose. It's a possibility. I'm definitely leaning towards the opinion that I'm not 100% convinced that Doom is the villain.
No, really?
But you think the villain is the villain? Hear me out, Helen. Guys? Hear me out.
They do set this up with the first line of the trailer.
I know they do.
Yeah. I think, like Thanos, misunderstood. But I genuinely do wonder when they talk about threats, and we talked about this for like an hour and a half, but whether the Doom is there to face a greater threat, but as with Thanos, his methods are perhaps a little on the nose.
Uh-huh. I cannot express how much I don't want to spend the next 2 years having this argument.
I'll be like, well, of course, Doom is the true hero of this phase of the MCU.
Yes, of course, like every villain thinks they're the good guy. At least most of them, there are some exceptions. Most villains think they're the good guy.
Michael Myers is pretty sure he's not the good guy.
I think he's got to know, right? He's got to know.
He's got to have an idea.
I get that. I understand that Doom will have a reason that seems rational and right to him. I do not need that represented in the studio all the time. Oh, God. Oh, God. What are we going to do?
It was a good trailer. There were a number of really cool shots. Of course, the coolest one was Infinity War Thor versus Doom.
Two fingers. Very Dragon Ball.
Yes. And yeah, I think I saw some green energy on the edge of the screen. So the sigils that he has, he's definitely got the command of magic that we...
you can see on his sort of gauntlet he's got.
Yes. I think there's no denying that it feels different to how it felt with Infinity War and Endgame, because the build up to those films was, it felt like the culmination of something, whereas this does not have that. And
if anything, I think this is a back on track sort of house clearing kind of a an event.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is almost the territory, the difficult territory that DC have walked, where you've got a team up that has not been yet earned.
Exactly.
And although I really like this trailer, and I did really like it, and it got me very excited, and I love the tonality of it, there is still a part of me that's just like, you're having a big team up of characters who, by and large, are not characters I'm all that bothered by. I mean, with a couple of exceptions, without a doubt. But these are not, I would say, a collection of characters that we know and love. They're characters that we kind of know-ish and don't really have strong feelings about.
That the MCU itself has forgotten about.
Yeah, it feels like this is like the B-team team-up. But that doesn't mean it won't be great.
True.
Yeah.
I'm holding out hope. And you know, it's been interesting seeing some of the reaction to this trailer, some, especially in the wake of the Odyssey, have found it underwhelming and like asking like, where's the story and stuff like that. And this is actually very consistent with how Marvel do trailers, especially for Avengers films. The first trailer is more about establishing the threat, which they do, and giving you cool shots and cool images. The second trailer is when they get into a bit of the story and prime the audience for that. And I think they're going to do that. Obviously, they've got Comic-Con coming up. I think the second trailer will definitely have multiple mentions of the word incursions to really sort of prime people about what that is. But yeah, I think as their first trailer, it was good. Yeah, I'm holding up hope that they'll stick the landing, but I do have some doubts and worries going into this.
Pretty psyched.
I thought it was a good trailer as well. Yeah. I get the same worries, but I'm looking forward to it.
Very much so. And if you want to hear us talk about this in, let's be honest, excruciating detail, do sign up to Empire Plus, because we do have a big old spoilery, well, it's not a spoilery because we literally know nothing about the film, but a chat about this trailer, a trailer reaction chat. For
Absolutely.
An hour, and I think it was 15 minutes.
But it's fine.
It's fine.
That's a normal amount
for
of time.
Two-minute trailer, it's all good.
Hey, everyone. It's Chris here, jumping in, as is my wont, with a little update on this week's episode. So, first things first, we're about to go into the news section. This was recorded on Wednesday, as Helen says, in the news section. And as a result, there's a lot of stuff that's happened over the last 24 hours or so. But James and Helen haven't been able to reconvene to discuss that. Things breaking at Comic-Con, that sort of thing. And we will discuss most of those things on next week's show. We will be doing a Comic-Con podcast special, reaction special. Dan Jolin of this parish is also here in San Diego. He's on official business. Very, very exciting. He's not here representing Empire, but nevertheless, he has agreed to do a podcast with me, which we'll be recording on Saturday night. I will, all being well, turn it around to go out on Sunday or Monday at the latest, and we'll be discussing everything that happened here at Comic-Con, all the people we talked to, all the panels we saw, all the cool things we did. So that'll be a fun one, and we can talk about all the stuff that's gone down here at Comic-Con, the mind-boggling return of Johnny Depp, doing a stunt today as Ebenezer Scrooge, for example, appearing in Hall H and at a pop-up installation in the middle of town. All those things will be discussed. The Marvel Studios panel, all those things will be discussed in that Comic-Con thing, and other news will be discussed as well in next week's episode. Right. Now, since January, I have turned this podcast into a one interview only podcast, and other interviews have been brought to you in a new regular feature called The Interviews. And because I'm in Comic-Con, and quite frankly, I'm massively up against it, I haven't had the time to do that this week. I haven't had the time to put together this week's episode of The Interviews. So therefore, what I'm going to do is, for 1 week only, you're getting a second interview. Just like old times. So you're getting my interview with the star of The Dink, the great Mary Steenburgen. And that's what you're about to hear now. Now, Mary Steenburgen, of course, an absolute legend with an Oscar-winning career that spanned some, six decades since her debut in Jack Nicholson's Western Going South. And since then, she's been seen in the likes of Time After Time, Melvin and Howard, for which she won that Oscar, Parenthood, Back to the Future Part 3, Elf, Step Brothers, it's a fucking Catalina wine mixer, and much, much more. And this week she stars In the Dink, which is an amiable Apple TV comedy, and she plays an older lady, Candace, whose pickleball skills lead to an unlikely friendship, and perhaps a little bit more, with an aimless former tennis champ played by Jake Johnson. I caught up with Steen Bergen on Zoom the other week, and we had a lovely chat about pickleball, about movies, and about music, to which she's turned her hand over the last few years with results almost as astonishing as the story of how she acquired those musical skills in the first place. I'll let her tell the story. I had a blast talking to Mary Steen Bergen. I will say that I had some technical difficulties. Had to abandon my microphone at the last minute and switch to AirPods. So I may not sound like my usual crisp self. A bit like now, actually. Almost as if I'm recording this in a San Diego hotel room. But I hope that that won't impair your listening experience too much, because Mary Steen Bergen is a delight, as you're about to find out. Here we go. Enjoy.
Mary, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Excellent. We're here to talk about The Dink, of course, in which you display your pickleball prowess. How familiar were you with pickleball when this movie was pitched to you?
My son, Charlie McDowell, who lives part of the time in London and who is a member of the Lemon Pickleball Club there. Shout out to you guys. He gave me a paddle and said, "Mom, people even older than you have beaten me at this game." I don't think they could do that anymore, but that was in the early days. And with that sweet little gift, he gave me my first paddle, and I started playing, and I've been pretty much playing ever since. And I really, 2 months into playing, I was told that there was a movie that they were offering me, and it was with Jake Johnson and Ben Stiller, which sounded amazing, directed by Josh Greenbaum, which was exciting, that it was a comedy, that it shot in LA, that it was a lead part. And then they said, "And it's about the sport of pickleball." And I said, "I'll do it." And they said, "Well, you have to read it." And I said, "I will read it, but I am going to do it, you know." So, and when I read it, it was a beautiful script, and it was just fantastically funny and made me instantly want to do it.
They had you with pickleball. I love, by the way, there's a what do you call them, pickleball bats?
Paddles.
Or rackets?
Paddles.
Paddles. Pickleball paddle that is right beside you. Is that the one that your son gave to you, or is that?
No, this is decoration.
Oh, just decoration. You have like an ultra deluxe one that you break out.
I don't just have one. I have quite a few of them. some of them I'm very sentimental about and I won't play with them. I'm already doing that kind of thing. It's like collecting guitars for musicians. You know, I'm quite sentimental about a few of them. There's one from when we were shooting The Dink, and Josh Greenbaum and Sean Clements, who wrote the wonderful script, they all signed it. So I'm never playing with that one.
And of course you are a musician. You are a songwriter as well.
I am.
So do you collect instruments also? Do you collect guitars?
I have quite a few accordions.
Accordions.
I know. It's weird, isn't it? I admit it. It's weird. I fell in love with it. And I play strange little French cafe songs to myself a lot. And also for my grandchildren. They like it. There's a certain age that people get to and they're like, "Get that accordion away from me." But I never hit that age, and my grandchildren are still think it's relatively cool.
How did you get into the accordion?
We were in McCabe's Music, which is a great music store in LA, and it was Valentine's Day, and my husband had bought me nothing. And I said, I said, it's pretty late in the day. Is there going to be a gift when I get home for Valentine's Day? And he goes, sadly, no. And I said, then can you buy me that little green accordion on the shelf up there? And he's like, yes, with great relief. And I think he thought it would be put on a shelf at home and never played. And I just became fascinated with the puzzle. I like puzzles. And the accordion is a puzzle that you're doing three different things at the same time. You're playing, in the case of a piano accordion, you're playing the piano, you're playing the buttons, which have chords, and you're going inside and out for the bellows. And so I just loved it and started playing it.
That's amazing.
I didn't say I play it brilliantly. I'm not brilliant at it, but I love it. Kind of like my pickleball passion, but no real prowess. No skill whatsoever, but a lot of passion.
I suspect not. I suspect you play brilliantly. But I'll get back to the dig in a second, but I'm just fascinated by this kind of musical chapter of your life as well. And that's something that's fairly late breaking and in a very unorthodox fashion it came your way.
It happened April 17th, 2007. I had a surgery on my right arm and we don't know precisely what happened. I'll never know. But the theory from an anesthesiologist friend said, I think they let your blood pressure get too low. And I think you had some little something that happened in the brain. I was the same person physically. I was the same person emotionally. But I had this, it's so hard to describe it, but it's as though this musical tornado took residency in my brain, so that I would pass a street sign and it would say Lost Lake Lane, and that became a song I wrote. And I never had seen the world through music before. I don't think I received a talent, but I received a sort of opening or obsession that has led to, again, I don't know if it's talent, but a skill, because I've actually really, that thing Malcolm Gladwell talks about, the 10,000 hours, I've spent many hours writing music now.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by this. And in a strange way, you know, I don't know if you think about cosmic coincidences or the universe giving you gifts in a way. It strikes me that, you know, playing pickleball and then 2 months later someone comes up to you and says, I know, I'm making a pickleball movie.
I know.
It just feels like the universe is handing you gifts over the last few years.
Yes. And the only thing that I guess I feel that was my part in it, because I do think I do believe in those sorts of gifts from the universe. The only thing I did right was that I said yes to both of them. Because a lot of times I think things come our way and we say, I can't do that. I don't do that. Many years ago, I went to a psychic in Dublin named Sandra Ramdani. And she told me that I was going to write music. And she saw this image of people standing and applauding and me receiving some sort of award for writing music. And it was at that moment when she was telling me this that I thought, oh, you're probably not a very good psychic, because that is not going to happen. There's no way that's going to happen. I'm not a musician. I have no idea how to write music. I can't imagine that I would ever know how to write music. And I don't even particularly want to write music. And I didn't believe it. And then all these years later, when this thing started happening, it took me a while to remember that. I think I was writing music 2 or 3 years before someone was talking about psychics. And I went, oh, my God, I was told about this one time and I never put it together. And so I learned from that, that when stuff comes along, you know, that is a gift to you, say yes. You know, yeah, I'm not a great pickleball player, but do I have so much joy in playing? Have I made friends? Do I go out with my granddaughter and play and just can't believe we're doing this? So much joy has come my way just from saying yes to it.
That's amazing. You go through the door that opens. I know, exactly, someone who told me that once.
Exactly.
Has that been something that has you clung to that throughout your career?
Yes.
You know, some
yes.
great films you've made or just... Yes, I'll do Step Brothers. Absolutely.
Yes. Step Brothers was scary because day one, those guys out of the gate were so extraordinary, so far above anything I could ever do improvisational. That's what it felt like. And I looked at the great, brilliant actor, Richard Jenkins, who was feeling exactly the same way I was. And we looked at each other and we went, what are we doing here? And I went home that night and I thought about it and I came back the next day and I said, Richard, I know what we're doing here. And he said, what? I said, we're making it real enough that we're enabling them to play two idiots that live at home with their parents. That's our job. Make it real. And it was from that moment on, Richard and I were locked into this, and we had the best time.
One of the things I was really taken with by in the film is that central relationship between Jake's Dustin and your Candace, because there is a hint of a romance between the two of you. I don't want to spoil this for people. I don't want to tell people where this goes.
Right.
But I'll be honest, Mary, I was rooting for you guys. I was rooting for you crazy kids to get together. Was that something that you felt as well? And was that something that developed out of being on set with Jake, finding chemistry with Jake and just playing around with material? Or was that always in the script, that connection between the two of them?
It was the hardest thing for, even before I came on, it was the hardest thing for them to figure out how that would end, how that story would end. And like you, I don't want to spoil it. So I'll just say that a lot of thought was given to what those two characters really needed. And sometimes I felt the same way you felt about it. And sometimes increasingly I felt that how it ends is sort of perfect. And it was an interesting thing because you know, there's a huge, not small, a huge age difference between us. And but there is also the fact that these two people in their own way are quite similar and they're both pretty quirky and they both are lost. And they both have similar, they need someone to show up for them. And in the end, they do that for each other.
Mm. Yeah, I agree. I thought it was interesting as well that, you know, this is a comedy, but it's a comedy with a lot of heart. But it was really interesting that it would even explore the possibility of a relationship between two people who, you know, one of whom is older than the other, and also
well, let's just be honest that the woman is older, because there have been plenty of films that were just fine with the man being way older than the woman.
I can't think of a single one, Mary.
Exactly.
I can think of a dozen, but I can't think of a single one. But yeah. I thought it was a really, really refreshing thing to see as well. And I'm so glad you guys explored that. Mary, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to let you go, but thanks so much for your time.
Let's move on to movie news. There has not been, I would say, a wild amount.
Well, Helen, there has been one big bit of news, and I talk about this on Monday's pilot, but for those of you who can't wait, it's to do with God of War, because Ryan Hurst, the ghost of Sparta, Kratos himself, we see him in the Odyssey with Telemachus. He is no longer going to be Kratos.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this, Amon? Are you happy? Are you sad? Does it open the door for Chris Judge to take the role? What do you think it means?
I am sad, because especially to have a really cool role like this and be injured in such a way.
Yeah, I think he tore his bicep.
Yes, yeah. That's just inherently sad, and I feel bad for Ryan Hurst, and I hope that he heals extremely quickly. Does this open the door for Christopher Judge? I would not be mad at that at all. Like, I think he's so great in that role in the games. He doesn't just do the voice, he does the mocap as well. If you're a God of War fan and you haven't watched the God of War documentaries, essentially, about the makings of that game, please do. Especially the God of War 2018, there's a really emotional moment when he's talking about the Blades of Chaos and getting those back in the game. And it meant a lot to Christopher Judge, not just in the game, but personally as well. And he kind of retells that story. It's very, very emotional. So I would love to see him take on the role personally, but we'll see. I know that you would also like that, because I remember talking to you about this.
Oh, my God, I can't believe that didn't cost him for the get-go.
Yeah.
I think it was, honestly, I think it was a massive own goal. Look, and I love Ryan Hurst. I think he's a great actor. And actually, I think he was a good choice, but only if you're not going to get Chris Judge. And I think Chris Judge is absolutely the man for this. He has the most astonishing voice. But also, you know, if people remember Stargate SG-1 when he was Teal'c, like, he's just great. Mm-hmm. Loads of time for Chris Judge. And I really, really, really do hope that they take this opportunity to do what they should have done in the first place.
If and when we do that with Chris Judge, do not release another photo like the one that you did at the start of this journey, because, God, that was bad.
It was.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Helen's well excited about this.
Cool. Great, guys. Thanks so much.
Helen, see, what you're doing there is you are pretending not to care, but I know you have a soft spot for Teal'c. I know
that
you are currently in the midst of a big old binge of SG-1. Okay. So.
First time, we're still going through it. Okay. I am one episode away from the end of season 10. At last.
Yes.
It has been
You are the
long,
Teal'c hive, aren't
it's
you?
It's been a long road. I am Teal'c hive, especially since he started wearing sleeveless shirts, but... I don't have any God of War feelings whatsoever. I can search my heart from here to forever.
I'll tell you this, the score for the games is done by Bear McQuarrie,
okay,
your
I'm
guy,
I'm
and those
board.
Scores it are freaking phenomenal.
Okay, I do like also Bear McQuarrie. He is my most listened to artist on Spotify most years, mostly because I work to a lot of Battlestar Galactica Rings of Power and so on. But I don't care about God of War, and I'm glad we've finished talking about it. There were a couple of trailers this week. So there was Other Mummy.
Can we talk about that jump scare in that trailer? Which, I don't know about you, it scared the absolute shit out of me.
Well, let us set up what the hell the film is first, shall we?
Go for it.
So this is Jessica Chastain playing the mother to a small girl, but also the other mummy, the mysterious and not nice, I'm going to venture, presence that haunts their house.
Yeah.
So the question in every scene that she's in, as far as I can tell, is going to be, is this mother source of comfort and food and safety and general love and care? Or is this other mummy terrifying beast from beyond?
Yes.
Don't know.
I have not had a chance to watch this yet, not because I'm a scaredy cat.
Sure.
It looks really good. I've seen a lot of chatter about it, and it's just interesting to me to see where we are vis-a-vis horror right now. Horror is really, really cooking, and it feels like everyone is trying to jump onto their own horror vehicle and find something that really sort of hits the spot. So, yeah, I will watch this trailer. I'm not. I'm a little bit scaredy cat, but I'm going to watch the trailer.
There is a scare, but it's the best kind of jump scare, which is not one where something jumps into the frame with a loud noise. It's something where something, and you see something in the back of the frame, and you're like, oh my Jesus, ah! Yeah. And I had a proper freak out. And I don't scare that easily in that way, but it really weirded me out.
Mm. Yeah.
Even the cover for the trailer, those very sinister smile that Jessica Chastain has, does that sort of show up, I guess, in the trailer?
Yeah, there's definitely a amount of that.
Kind of Joker. This is also, we should say, directed by Rob Savage, who obviously has horror forum in things like Host and...
Dashcam,
and the slightly less successful, I think, The Bogeyman, although I was still scared. Just to be clear. And also stars Jay Duplass, Arabella Olivia Clarke is the kid. You've got Ditchin Lachman in there, Ariane Moayed, and Karen Allen. So it's a good cast all over. I'm freaked out, but I will have to go see it, I guess. So, yeah. And just while we've been talking about other Mummy, the trailer has dropped for Clayface. The latest trailer has dropped for Clayface, the upcoming DC film. This was the one with the script by
Mike Flanagan
and directed by
James Watkins,
and is starring
Naomi Aki, Tom Rhys-Harris Clayface. Who is also star?
It's got Max Minghella in there.
Yes,
Eddie Marsan.
Yes, he plays a cop. Yeah.
This is really emphasizing, I would say, the body horror aspect of this film. If you enjoyed the bit in The Matrix where Neo's mouth disappears, this is the film for you.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm really, really excited for this. Mike Flanagan, who wrote this, part of his inspiration for the script was Batman the Animated Series. There's a two-part episode in that series called Feet of Clay, which is sensational. If you have not watched that, I highly recommend doing so. But that was part of the inspiration for his script here. And as he's mentioned, it definitely gets into the body horror aspect of it. I think what was also at play here is just the tragedy of Clayface. I hope that really comes through, because he's a really tragic character. I'm really, really excited. I think this has actually come at the perfect time for DC, who are a little bit sort of their experiment is not going
on the back foot.
On the back foot right now. But as we mentioned, like, horror is really in vogue right now, and if this can really bridge the gap between not only the comic book stuff but the horror stuff in a really effective way, then this could arrive at the perfect time for them. So, yeah, fingers crossed.
How are you feeling, James?
I am very whelmed.
Wow.
The first teaser actually really intrigued me.
Mm-hmm.
This trailer felt wildly generic. Mm-hmm. I was just like, I must admit, I'm really disappointed in that trailer. I can't speak to the film, I haven't seen it. But, you know, and Mike Flanagan being involved in the story really gives me hope, because I have a lot of faith in him. But this had Morbius vibes to me.
No, I'm sorry.
It just seemed like really lame, and they were just leading in, like, a lot of the... You know, I was wondering if there would be interesting, ambiguous horror narrative stuff. And there might be, but the beats in this trailer are very much like, you know, villain or unfortunate hero or anti-hero origin stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the body horror stuff, again, like, there are a couple of shots in this which are generally quite grim and actually quite good. But there's one in particular that I would say is on a par with that one from 1999's The Matrix. And I was just like, bad CGI, gooey flesh stuff. I don't know. I have real concerns about this now.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
What about you, Helen? What do you think?
I was scared, so I'm in. Yeah, I think it's going to be fun. But yeah, we shall say, look, you could be 100% right, James, but we've got to hope.
I really hope I'm not, because actually I was quite excited about the idea of this.
Mm.
And the first teaser genuinely is quite unnerving. So I'm hoping that this is just a very broad trailer, because presumably they're having a bit of a, oh my God, how do we market this type thing? Are we marketing it to horror fans, to superhero fans? Who are we trying to please? If the first teaser was marketed at horror fans, I feel like this teaser is marketed at the kind of comic DC faithful. So maybe the film falls somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, I would imagine so.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
Also, very on brand for a week when we're talking about Pompeii and there is a nightclub called Vesuvius. It's like we planned this show, except that we very obviously didn't. No. They've also announced this week that the Snoop Dogg biopic, which is a thing that is happening.
Snoop Dogg,
It has a release date, and it's going to be out next summer on the same day as the Bluey movie, an event that I want to be the first to call Dog Day after.
Yes. That's
very good.
That is brilliant, and it must happen.
I hope that this is our Barbenheimer night.
Dog with two G's, obviously.
Of course, yeah. With two G's. I genuinely don't know how we also fall in Jason Statham stole my bike, which is apparently out the same day in the US. But look, I do what I can. hand, Dog Day Afternoon is a thing. Bluey versus Snoop Dogg. Who will reign supreme? I mean, it's Bluey.
It's Bluey.
What do we think about a Snoop Dogg biopic?
It could be really, really fun. They got Jonathan J.D. Davis to play Snoop Dogg in this. The last time I think Snoop was on screen was in Straight Outta Compton, and he was played by Lakeith Stanfield in that movie.
Not tall enough, but that's right. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
Or skinny enough. And he's a skinny guy, but like Snoop is...
Yeah.
Whew. I think you forget, of course, that he was in the Lego documentary.
He was.
About Pharrell.
Yeah. Piece by piece.
They sprayed PG spray all around him every time he was on screen.
That was a fun moment.
That was very funny. If you haven't seen Piece by Piece, I highly recommend it. Literally, even for that joke, it's worth seeing, but it's a really fun movie.
Yeah. But he's got the catalogue of tunes for sure to help power this, which will be fun to hear blasted from cinema screens.
I guess so. And this is directed by Craig Brewer.
Yes.
Who, of course, did Hustle and Flow and most recently Song Sung Blue.
Which I really liked.
It'll be a little bit of a change from Song Sung Blue.
Just a smidge.
Just a smidge. Yeah. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Do we think it will break $1 billion? Like, No, I agree.
Okay. I don't think
Let's
so.
Let's move on.
The things that have...
Well, speaking of... Yes.
Not quite that, broken a billion yet, but...
No. Things that have made big money at the box office. The Odyssey opened to $264 million worldwide, or thereabouts, which is... 1, 2, 3, a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of money.
Yes, and that is apparently unadjusted for inflation, the best opening of Christopher Nolan's career, beating The Dark Knight Rises.
Which is incredible.
Not adjusted for inflation, but I think it should be adjusted for the fact that fewer people go to the cinema now. So even if you adjust for inflation, but you also adjust for that, I feel like it's still an incredible result. And that is correct. You should all be going to see The Odyssey on the big screen. I know some of you out there need babysitters or like long trips across the tundra to get to a cinema, but I genuinely, this is the one to make an effort for, I think, at the moment.
Until June comes out.
Yes, but that's the 6 months, well, 5 months away, you know? Yeah. You've got time right now.
All showings at the BFI IMAX are booked out until September.
Yeah.
That is completely insane.
It's particularly insane given how many seats in that IMAX are dreadful. Because if you are down the front on the side, you're just going to be looking at Odysseus's armpit for like 3 hours.
Counterpoint, there are 41 cinemas in the world that are capable of showing 70 millimeter full IMAX.
Really?
41 in the world. We have two in London.
Where's the other one?
The Science Museum.
Is it the other? I did not know that.
Full IMAX.
But still, Helen, think about people's necks.
Yeah. Think about the necks,
look,
Helen.
I agree. I'm not thinking about necks. I'm always thinking about necks. Anyone who knows me is like, she's thinking about necks.
Yeah.
My husband will turn to me and go, are you thinking about necks? And I have to be like, yes, I'm thinking about necks.
Wind your neck in, Helen.
All I'm saying is, we're very privileged here in the studio to have seen it in one of those 41 screens.
Yeah, Amon and I particularly privileged because we had an empty cinema and we were literally able to pick the perfect seats, which were the back row.
You moved seat just as the film began because you're like, the guy below you is like, that's going to annoy me.
I'm not saying we were sitting in an empty IMAX and a dude sat right in front of me. I'm not saying that happened, but it fucking did. It wasn't Boris Johnson. He was sitting further down. And yes, I did move.
Yes.
I moved along a few.
Yeah. But I think this establishes that Nolan is just the number one director. I think, well, Vulture just released a piece about who are the most powerful directors in the world right now. Nolan is number one and Kubrick is number two. And I think that number one and two is right because Nolan now, with regularity, his films become cultural moments. Like, The Odyssey is this year's Sinners in terms of people going back to the cinemas, in terms of the chatter about it, the memes about it. The Odyssey was created that moment. And obviously, last year, that was Sinners. Even Oppenheimer, that was part of the Barbenheimer, which was another cultural moment. Nolan has created that regular thing now with his movies. He's the number one guy. And to have that return, when you have a film like The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises in your catalogue, and to have this opening be bigger than that, that is hugely impressive.
Well, he's the name now, I think, in the way that Villeneuve filmmakers...
I'm
not saying Villeneuve isn't... I'm saying, like, Nolan definitely is.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, with love and respect for Villeneuve, suggest that Nolan is a bigger name for the average person than Villeneuve is.
You wound me with your words.
Love and respect. Apparently, it was controversial of them to include Greta Gerwig in the top five of that list. And can I say to anyone who's outraged at that, get in the fucking bin. She has made three nailed-on classics, none of which were necessarily easy films to nail. And she is now making a Narnia movie. And she seems to be able to do no wrong. So, yeah, I think she absolutely belongs in that company. We shall 100%. See with Narnia next year. I think that's the major news as we record. We are recording on Wednesday just because of the life. So if there is other, if there are other appalling or terrifying things that come out of Comic-Con, then we may have to reconvene at some point and discuss those. But basically, at the moment, that's news.
Yeah.
We should, however, take a moment for some rather sad news that broke this week. So first of all, there was the sad death of Brenda Fricker, the Irish actress who won an Oscar for her role in My Left Foot, and who was also remembered by a generation of children for being the pigeon lady in Home Alone 2. Mm-hmm. But she was a lot more than that. I do want to be clear. Like, as well as winning Best Supporting Actress for My Left Foot, she was in The Field, which is an incredible film. She appeared in things like A Time to Kill, Angels in the Outfield, So I Married an Axe Murderer, all in that sort of early 90s period after she'd won her Oscar. Veronica Guerin, a bit more recently, which is a great film, Inside I'm Dancing. She had been a great stage actress before that and appeared in some of the greatest sort of Irish plays and stage plays in Ireland throughout her life. And she had been ill for a while, but we're still very sad that she died at the age of 81, the very first Irish actress to win an Oscar. There was also the absolutely heartbreaking news this week that Kaylee Hottle, who was the young deaf actress from the Godzilla versus Kong movies, died in a car crash. So completely sudden, completely unexpected, and incredibly tragic. She was a really fine actress in those movies, and I was looking forward to seeing much more from her, I hoped, in future.
Yeah,
so our thoughts go out to the family and friends of both women. Rest in peace to both of them. Okay, it's time now for an interview. And as promised, I think discussed both last week and this, we did indeed send Chris to Naples and thence to the ancient city of Pompeii, where Vesuvius did not erupt and bury him in a cloud of ashes and stones.
Praise be.
Instead, he got to hang out with Tom Hiddleston and find out about his new three-part documentary series, Pompeii Out of Time with Tom Hiddleston. That's all the title, which is out on Nat Geo right now as you're listening to this. So here are Chris and Tom talking about, I assume, I haven't heard the interview yet, ash clouds and mayhem, subjects that both are surely familiar with by now. Okay, please enjoy.
Hey everyone, it's Chris here, just jumping in real quick from my one bunk Hilton at the San Diego Comic-Con to say that, yes, Pompeii Out of Time with Tom Hiddleston was broadcast on Nat Geo this week, but it also lives on Disney Plus over here in the UK. So if you want to see it, that's where you go. You go to Disney Plus. All right, here's the interview. Bye. Tom Hiddleston.
Chris Hewitt.
Welcome back to the Empire Podcast.
It's such a pleasure.
Where the hell are we, Tom?
We're not where we normally are.
No, we're not.
Let's
we're
face
not
it.
In a London hotel room.
No.
Or King's Place.
Well, you know, no.
Or the back of a dumpster around Asda.
Yeah.
We're not in any of those places.
Empire.
Or indeed Empire offices.
In the Empire offices.
Yeah, that's weird. That was the fourth place I thought of. That's a place I actually worked. Yeah. Where are we, Tom?
Where are we? We are just above the ancient site of Pompeii. In the shadow of Mount Vesuvius, which is now silhouetted against the evening sky,
mm-hmm.
with the Bay of Naples behind us, where Pliny the Elder was commanding the Roman Imperial fleet as he watched Vesuvius erupt in AD 79.
Oh my God!
We're in just south of Naples.
We're surrounded by history.
We're surrounded by history, and not it's just amazing. Ancient history, modern history.
Modern
history,
yeah.
Maradona.
He was wreaking havoc.
He was.
Down there.
Down in
on the pitch, off the pitch.
In them there hills.
Yes. You can still hear his voice. Yeah,
exactly.
You can still hear the cries of Diego Maradona.
Yeah.
And we're here, Tom, because I think this might be the greatest pivot since Ross from Friends bought a sofa. This is this is incredible because you are here. You're fronting a documentary, but you're not hosting it in the Ant and Dec style. This
no,
is a
indeed.
Proper historical examination
yeah.
of Pompeii
of what happened in Pompeii.
That's it. That's and it's
called, I'll leave it. I've summed it up.
You've summed it up. It's called Pompeii Out of Time, and it's for National Geographic, and it's on Disney Plus. And it's extraordinary. They approached me with an idea, and it was the germ of an idea, really. And they were very clever because I knew I had studied classics at university.
Yes.
Before I became an actor, that was my specialist area of study. That was my BA, my bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. And it was something I genuinely loved as a young person. And they asked me if I'd like to make a show about Pompeii, not knowing that I had come to Pompeii at the age of 17, just before doing my A-levels in 1998. France 98, World Cup summer. Time is
Maradona,
time is circular. So, is exactly. I remember it so well. I was literally just about to leave school, and it must have been, I think it was my first trip away without grown-ups.
Okay.
The first time I ever went away to a foreign country on my own with two friends.
Wow.
But we were unsupervised, and so we had to, you know, account for ourselves and budget and get ourselves around, and nobody had done any planning. So you learn a lot about life anyway on those trips.
Uh-huh.
And for that reason, it was really exciting.
Did you rock up at Pompeii almost accidentally? Did you drift here in a way?
I was studying Latin and Greek at A-level. I had a friend who was studying ancient history and another friend who was studying history of art. And Italy, we just loved Italy. It is a great place to come in the summer anyway.
Yeah.
And it seemed to be this in the perfect kind of Venn diagram of all of our interests. We went to Rome, and we looked at all the Renaissance art there too, and all the ancient history in the Forum. And we went out to Hadrian's Villa, which is just outside Rome, and then we got the train, and we got an Interrail ticket. Back in the days, you could buy those things. I think it was 250 odd pounds, and you could get on any train in Europe for free.
Bring that back.
A bargain.
That absolutely is.
And so we got the sleeper from Paris to Rome, and then we beetled around Rome, and then we got another big train from Rome to Naples, and we beetled around here. And Pompeii was on the list. It was in the rough guide. It was in the Lonely Planet, and I knew about it.
Yeah.
But I had nothing prepared me for walking into Pompeii for the first time. I don't know quite what I was expecting. I had seen Roman ruins before, but I had never seen anything archaeological of that scale. It was an entire town, the size of Bath, the size of Oxford, massive streets. We use these terms all the time, like following in the footsteps. But you walk through the streets of Pompeii, and you are literally standing on the same paving stones. You can walk down streets, disappear down alleyways, turn a corner, see the way there's a bakery or a private house or an amphitheater or a marketplace where they sold bread and fish and olives. This is all 2,000 years ago.
Mm.
And this is honestly what happened at the age of 17. It felt like time travel.
Mm.
It felt suddenly the ancient world, which I'd read about in books and in class on paper, came alive. It was a real place you could visit. And then the relationship with the past was something that was a living, breathing thing. And it really struck me, as we were talking before we, you know, came on air, about, I saw that there were many plaster casts made of people who didn't make it in the eruption of Vesuvius and the covering of Pompeii. But one of the things that really moved me as a 17-year-old was seeing the plaster cast of a dog who'd been chained to the family dog who'd been chained to a wall and was trying to escape. And we had a family dog, and it was about the same size. And I thought, these people, the sense of that history can sometimes give you, that people from the past, from the distant, deep past, are just like us.
Yeah.
And the tension between knowing how genuinely far away that is. 2,000 years is a really long time.
Mm.
Almost too long for us to kind of conceive of.
Mm.
It's so many generations. And yet they were also not like us, and there's a tension between that proximity and that distance that you know, illuminated some very serious light bulbs for me in terms of my curiosity about history, about the world, about wanting to understand who we are and where we came from. That was very real and very sincere as a young person. I could see that the ancient Rome and ancient Greece is the foundation, certainly, of European culture, not of global culture, because there are so many other influences in Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia. But in Europe, we kind of go back to Greece and Rome, and I wanted to study our beginnings, because I thought it would give me an understanding of who we are. So that became my degree, and now here we are, you know.
I mean, it strikes
three decades later.
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me as well that I've seen all three episodes now, that is there an element of speaking to the present as well in terms of the people of Pompeii ignored the warning signs about Vesuvius.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, they didn't have the breadth of our knowledge. They didn't know what we know.
Yeah.
If that volcano over there started rumbling right now, Tom, I would be over there as fast as you could. Yeah, I would be. I'd be gone
across the bay.
Yeah, I'd be bye, Hiddleston. Yeah. I'm out of here. Yeah. But you know, we do have the benefit of that knowledge.
Yeah.
Are you, in a way, trying to speak to us, modern day humanity, and the fact that, you know, we might perhaps ignore warning signs that are happening all around us right now?
Right. You're absolutely right. We have the means of accumulating the knowledge. We have the tools, so that there are no mysteries. For Pompeii, for the inhabitants of Pompeii, the volcano was had never happened before.
Yeah.
They knew about tremors and earthquakes. They knew sometimes the ground shook, and it was a bit weird. And pots would fall off the wall and things would break and you'd have to rebuild a bit. But the mountain, and people forget the reason there was such settlements here is the land was so rich.
Mm.
The soil was so fertile. The crops were bountiful. It's very nourishing soil. And suddenly the mountain explodes with more thermal energy than the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the volcanic debris, which is pumice, ash, and rock at 300 degrees Celsius, shoots 10s, 20s, 30 miles into the sky, into space essentially, grows out like a mushroom cloud or an umbrella pine tree, as described by Pliny. And then what goes up must come down, and it becomes like a storm of fire.
Yeah.
But to watch it happen must have felt like, to them, is this a storm, an unusual storm, and will we wake up tomorrow morning and the skies will be clear again? Because they would have endured, they would have seen thunder and lightning.
Yeah.
They would have understood, you know, what we think of as meteorological intensity.
Yeah.
And this may have looked like that, but it was the mountain. However, we live in a world where we have so much at our disposal where we can gather information, understand it. And we do have to, we should listen to the warnings.
Yeah.
And I think there was something very, as I said, I think in the show we tell stories about the past to understand something about the present. What was very resonant for me is that, and what I learned for the first time in making the show, was that in the wake of Pompeii there was a full-blown humanitarian crisis, and that people had survived and they were now completely homeless, without a place to belong, and refugees from a natural disaster. And that those images, suddenly the images being painted for me by historians and archaeologists and classicists, were very resonant of the world we live in, where there you know, climate related natural disasters happening all the time, and earthquakes and tsunamis, and people who are very vulnerable and need our help. And that seemed to me like a very contemporary image, but actually it's similar in the ancient world.
Yeah.
And what I hope it does is it generates renewed empathy for each other, really. That we all live on this remarkable, miraculous planet, and we need to preserve it and preserve life on it as much as we can.
Damn straight. Is part of that, is part of generating that empathy, part of that why you chose to host it in the way that you host it?
Yeah.
Which is not a very dry, hello, I'm talking to the camera about history, kind of way. Although you do deliver pieces to camera.
Sometimes,
This is essentially another acting job for you. You have to tell the story of these three potential survivors as well. Get us invested in them.
Yes.
And the way you do that is that you become invested in them.
Yeah.
Incredibly emotionally invested in them.
Yeah.
Well, can you talk me through that approach?
It's so odd because it actually, the process of it is almost like playing a character. Yes, that when you take on a fictional character or a real person you're playing in real life, which I've done now several times, there's a process which is very, for me, quite academic and intellectual, which is a lot of research, a lot of reading, a lot of looking things up, a lot of looking online, reading books, talking to people, interviews, facts, photographs. You know, what can I find out about this person? But the same is true of fictional characters too.
Yeah.
What can I find out about? Is there a book this is based on? And then eventually the head stops talking and the heart starts to speak. And you start to emotionally get attached to people. And I can't help it, actually. It's a really natural process for me. The more my imagination starts to become very active and involved in the story. And I knew going ahead, I thought that would be a really interesting kind of synthesis of my experiences. I've spent, you know, over 25 years in an act of imagination and empathy. Yeah. That's the job of an actor.
Yeah.
And also to have all this research, and that somehow the show could be an empathy machine that would hopefully invigorate and revitalize, reimagine the lives of people who lived a long time ago, and that we could feel for them as if they were here yesterday or last week. And that I love the challenge of that, meeting that challenge of telling the story in that way.
So just talk me through how you found these three potential survivors.
All research. There was so many more, and it's research that's being upgraded and updated and added to all the time. And that the gift of Pompeii is there's writing everywhere.
Yeah.
Graffiti and people writing their names, some of it very rude, a lot of it very silly, about people sort of bathroom habits. The sort of stuff that we see in petrol station walls at home.
Something I may have written.
Yeah, right.
Let's be honest.
But the best thing about it is it's really ordinary and it's everywhere. Now they've got the technology that they can track the occurrence of a name. They find the name in Pompeii on a headstone or on a wall or in a house, and they see where else they find this name because they didn't have pens and paper, they wrote on the walls all the time. And if you find the same name outside Pompeii and it's dated to after the eruption, it means that person made it out. So you've got this extraordinary fragment of history, which is an incidental piece of graffiti, but actually it tells you, here is a survivor.
Wow.
And that's how we found Avianius, the teenage boy, is that his name exists like in a different part of Italy.
Yeah.
So you find him in Pompeii, but you find him outside, which means he made it out. And the more research you do, you realize we found these three amazing people, but there's more, there's so many more. We found it difficult to pick, actually. But in the end, it seemed like these three quite different people was going to be a really interesting way in.
Was this a test? This is the last thing I'm going to ask you. Was this a test of your Latin skills? Madly. Have they lain dormant for many, many years?
Dormant and possibly dying. possibly on the decline, on the wane. I remembered that Latin is something you have to stay. Yeah, you have to keep practicing.
Uh-huh.
As they say, if you don't use it, you lose it.
And how would they say that in Latin, Tom?
I don't know. Something about utilitare, perdure.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe like, si non utilitarandum.
Uh-huh.
Perdendum.
Okay, give me that one more time.
Si non utilitarum.
Si non utilitarum.
Perdendum.
Esper. Couldn't have said it better myself. I took Latin for 1 year at school before they declared it the dead language and we stopped it. And the only thing I can remember of Latin is ambulo.
Very good.
That's it.
Yes.
That's all.
Which means?
To walk.
That's right.
Yeah. So.
So if you amble down the street. What else? How else does that feature in English? There's ambling.
Ambulance.
Maybe? Ambulance. Yeah.
I guess.
Although you kind of don't want ambulances to amble. You want a little bit more pep in the step.
Let's pick it up here, guys. I'm dying.
Yeah.
But there you go.
Yeah. There you go.
Ambularum.
Yeah, Ambulare. That's how it declines.
That's okay.
Cornerstone of Western civilization, guys.
I know one word.
French, Spanish, Italian. There you go. You surely know the Latin word for love.
Oh, no, go on. What is it?
What's the Italian word for love?
Amore.
There you go.
Is that it?
Amor, yeah.
See, points for me. Fantastic.
The Michael Haneke movie, Amor, that's the Latin.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah, Amore. Amore.
I know some Latin.
La vita è bella.
Yeah, dolce et decorum est, etc.
There you go.
Et cetera. Yeah, there you go. Anyway, on that note.
I'm learning a lot. You know a lot more Latin than I thought.
I like to teach you something every now and again.
Okay.
Just to turn
dolce
the tables on you.
Dolce et decorum est. Kids, yeah. If you don't know the poem,
yeah,
look it up.
Absolutely.
Wilfred Owen or Siegfried Sassoon?
Wilfred Owen.
Wilfred Owen.
Yeah. A cracking poem. And on that note, Tom Hiddleston,
it's time for me
to ambulo my way out of here.
We'll ambulo towards Vesuvius and hope it stays dormant.
Take our chances and see what happens.
Okay.
Pleasure, man.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
All right. Film reviews now. Let's talk about where to start.
Where to start from this box of delights?
Everyone is running scared from the Odyssey.
Yes, they are.
It is very clear. Everyone is running scared from the Odyssey. There are pretty much literally no new films in cinemas. There is nothing new in wide release.
Although we should start maybe with Deepwater, because this is Rennie Harlan's new film, and this was going to be in the cinemas, but then for reasons unknown, it has not gone to cinemas and it has come straight to digital. Oh, God.
I was going to go from best to worst, but if you want to start with Deepwater, let's start with Deepwater.
We're going to start with the big release. Oh, God. Do you know what the most interesting thing about this film is?
Rennie Harlan directed it?
It's produced by Gene Simmons. Gene Simmons of the band Kiss is the producer of this film, or a producer of this film. And that is the most interesting thing about it. This is the new Rennie Harlan film. Oh, God. And this takes place. There is an international commercial flight from Los Angeles to Shanghai. Ben Kingsley is the man at the stick. He's flying the plane. He spent a week shooting a cockpit. It's more of a cameo than anything else. Aaron Eckhart is the first officer. His name is Ben. And let's get the actor's name. Who is the actor I'm thinking of? Who is the actor? Come on, bring it up, because I don't know.
Angus Sampson.
Angus Sampson plays Hutch. And Hutch is maybe the worst person who's ever been in any film ever. None of us have ever wanted to murder another human being more than we have wanted to see Hutch get eaten by a shark.
I wanted to reach through the screen and strangle him.
Genuinely terrible human being.
When we say that every villain thinks he's the good guy, surely this guy
definitely doesn't think he's the good guy. This raging bellend, among other things, puts a power pack in his checked luggage. Shock, horror, dismay. Don't do this, kids. It causes a fire. The fire causes part of the plane to explode and decompress into a quite gnarly crash sequence where people are being hit in the face with suitcases and getting bludgeoned.
Credit where it's due. That's nasty.
It's a pretty good crash. Engines blow up. They have to ditch in the ocean. And wouldn't you know it, the waters are shark infested.
And they are very hungry.
And then what you essentially get is, and it's unusual because clearly this plane, it's supposed to be going to Shanghai. When they're going down, ditch in a giant water tank with a green screen around it. And that's really handy because then that's where the rest of the film is clearly set.
Why did they put the sharks in the water tank?
I mean,
James?
It seems silly. If you're going to have a big green screen water tank, you check for sharks first. And then they clearly didn't. But then, of course, they were obviously CG sharks, so maybe that was the reason why. The idea here is they have to try and, you know, not get eaten, move between bits of wreckage, people get limbs bitten off, sharks chow down on people. The thing with this film is, it's like 1985 called and they want their film back. Yeah. Like, it is the most regressive throwback movie I have seen in a really long time. Because it's like a comedically bad disaster movie, except without, you know, comedy. And it's so, like, the compositing is so glaring and the CGI is, I mean, it's not like it's not like it's bad. They look like sharks, but they're so obviously computer generated. Mm-hmm. And then the characters are incredibly two-dimensional. You know, God bless Angus Sampson. Like, he was clearly told, make this guy the most loathsome person on earth. And God knows he absolutely did it. Mm-hmm. But that's not a human being. That's not a real character. No one in this is really believable. Their motivations make no sense. The fact that, you know, old Ben, our first officer, wants to get back to his sick child and stuff is, okay, great. Yeah, he has a personal life. Thank you very much for sharing. And then there's the bit where, you know, fucking Chekhov's LoJack gets, you know, introduced in one of the early scenes. I wonder if that'll be helpful. Mm. This is so bad. It goes from bad to so bad it's good to so bad it's actually not good. It's just terrible. And honestly, I would begrudgingly give this a single star. I resent the time I spent watching it. I'm furious. It genuinely, along with the other films I saw this week, made me ring the klaxon for the death knell of cinema. Good God.
Whoa.
Wow. I mean, wow. Okay. I didn't like it either, if I'm honest. I thought it was, yes, trite and silly. I will give it a little bit of credit for killing some people immediately that I didn't think it would kill.
Mm-hmm.
But then it saved a bunch of people that I thought were nailed on, you know, plot armor, and sure enough they were. So that was kind of disappointing. I don't know. There's been a bunch of these kind of like shark plus plane movies recently. No Way Up was actually a pretty good one a couple of years ago, certainly relative to this.
What was the one with sharks in the Seine? What was that one?
It should have been called Insane.
It should have been.
But it was just like under Paris.
That was kind of fun.
That was fun. Yeah. There's no plane crash though.
There's no plane crash, but you had French sharks.
Yeah. And again, well, just to be clear, like sharks, less dangerous than, for example, hippos. Like, sharks not after us on purpose. So, yeah. But except in this telling, obviously. Yeah, it's not good. We don't have an official Empire review, but it's down there, isn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't great, but I didn't hate it as much as you did, Jose, I have to say. And honestly, full credit to Angus Sampson for his performance, because the place that I know him the most from is The Lincoln Lawyer, the Netflix series. Mm. And he's one of the good guys in that. And he's fun to watch in that. So to play someone so hateable, I mean, he really understood.
So hateable.
I wanted to... I mean, I sent you a message about
yes,
it. This prick. Oh, my goodness. I think that worked. And I think you generally spend just enough time with these very earnest archetypes that some of their final moments at times do sort of feel a little bit emotional. So I didn't all the way hate this.
High praise.
I didn't
eat them all. Eat them all. I was rooting for the sharks in this film.
Wow.
So you're like a 2-star.
I'm a 2-star.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm on the 1-2 borders. I'll be honest.
Okay.
It's not
wow.
good. It's. I'll be honest. I know we have 3 films I've seen this week. And I keep forgetting one of them. And they've all had a turn of being the one I forget. That's where we are, like, quality-wise with this week's films. So they do not stick in the memory. The good news, James, is that you will not be able to remember any of these films.
That is true. Like most trauma, it will be, my brain will blot it out.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a film that's out there, and it's not good. And we're sorry, Renny Harlin. We liked your earlier films.
Yes, we did.
When they were exciting. But credit for The Plane Crash. Maybe that brings
up to it. The Plane Crash is good.
The Plane Crash is scary. Yeah. I'd give it maybe a 2 just for that.
Honestly, it feels like every way you could die from a plane going bad, the film covers in that plane crash. Like, objects flying at you, hitting you in the head, people getting pulled out of the plane midair, people getting drowned, people getting trapped. Like, it's just like carnage everywhere.
I am going to say, just as a public service announcement, if you are on a plane with 2 very small children and you leave them alone to go and shag in the toilets, you deserve to get eaten by sharks.
That's fair.
Just a fact.
That's fair. All right. Well, I'm sure we'll have much better results with our next film. I'm going to say we go to 72 Hours next, which is the Tim Story film starring Kevin Hart, Marcelo Hernandez, Mason Gooding, and other people. Tiana Taylor's in it as well. And it's the story of Kevin Hart as an ad executive who claims to be 40. I mean...
Because Kevin Hart's what, 46?
He's 47. He's 47.
47,
I guess.
Okay.
It's okay. Okay, he claims to be 40. He needs to research what Gen Z likes. So when he accidentally gets added to a group chat of a group of guys planning a stag do, he decides to go along with them, and he'll pay for them. So they're willing to go with this because they have no money.
At all.
Yeah, and he's basically trying to do covert research for a drinks company. So the premise is, to put it generously, flimsy as fuck.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. And then the film has to bend over backwards again and again and again to A, give these people reasons to keep this man around, and B, get them into stupid situations that no human being would be in any circumstances ever. Of course, because they go to Miami for this bachelor party, as the Americans call it, there are like Cuban-coded drug lords. Because of course there are, right? Like
it's very trippy.
It's like they decide to just like accidentally fall into a Michael Bay Bad Boys movie for no reason. And of course that's badly done until like maybe one moment near the very end. I didn't buy a single second of this. It's not funny. I think all the younger comedians do their best to make it funny.
Yeah.
I think Mason Gooding, who by the way is Cuba Gooding Jr.'s junior.
I did not know that.
Yeah. He's the one from Scream. The more recent Screams. He's good, and they avoid one trope there because they have the groom not have an existential crisis about getting married. And I like that.
Well, he has a very brief one. A very brief one.
No, but it's not his crisis about getting married. It's his crisis about everything else around it. It's not about his relationship. I appreciated that one thing in this film. But everything else I thought was weak as fuck. So, I mean, I could go to a 2 to be generous, but I want them to know that I'm being generous. It does, like, I want to be thanked a lot.
They
like,
throw in a willycopter early on to try and get your attention, so I guess there's that. it's aggressively anti-funny, isn't it? Like, if this, you get the impression that, you know, from a science point of view, if this humor were to combine with a funny film, the universe would explode when anti-funny and funny are kind of introduced in the same space. There is, however, and this is why this film I would grudgingly go to a 2 on, there is one joke in this that genuinely made me giggle, and it is that he has, without spoiling anything, he has a slight personality change when he does cocaine. And
that made you laugh?
Genuinely, I found that funny. I don't know why, but that made me laugh.
That was the worst part of the film. Are you insane?
I know. I don't know why, but for whatever reason, that bit amused me. And so I gave it a little bit of charity. But no, it's not good on any level.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, yeah, so a star or 2 for 72
this is going
hours.
Well.
Did you see this, Amon? Did you get a chance to see this?
I did not get a chance to see this. Okay. And looks like I dodged
the bullet. No, you dodged the bullet. Yes, well done.
Well, speaking of dodging, ducking, and diving, and sports that would be on ESPN 8 El Ocho, brings us to The Dink, which is the new film directed by Josh Greenbaum and starring really good people.
Mm-hmm.
Jake Johnson is the lead in this film. It's nice to see him be the lead in something. Mm-hmm. Mary Steenburgen, who is awesome, is in this. Ben Stiller is in this. Ed Harris is in this. Andy Roddick and John McEnroe turn up for no reason. This has good people in it, and it does some unexpected things.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a premise that has the potential to be a solid middle-of-the-road comedy, and it wastes so much potential. Anyway, this story is that Jake Johnson was raised to be a tennis star by his overbearing father, Ed Harris, and then basically squandered all his opportunities straight after going pro and is now a washed-up tennis coach at his father's club.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a tension at the club between the pickleball players who are, let's face it, ascendant, and the old school tennis players. And there, of course, there's rumors of a championship match that will determine who gets more courts. You can see where this is going. I feel like it's insulting my intelligence even to lay out the plot. Anyway, Mary Steenburgen also turns up as a pickleball player, and she and Jake Johnson become pickleball partners when he's injured and has to play pickleball.
This is the most you've ever said pickleball in your life.
It really is, and I don't like it. I don't even like pickles. I don't know why I'm saying this. Anyway, they have to play pickleball together for reasons, and the film is kind of about their friendship and that relationship and how that develops in some interesting ways. I I didn't think this was bad. Unlike the other two films, I don't think it's bad. I even think it has some funny jokes in it, although not all of them belong in this film. Like, there's a running gag when John McEnroe shows up that he always has.
You cannot
snacks.
Be serious.
Nay. Yeah. He cannot be serious. Anyway, he's always got a snack with him. And where did this snack come from? And that's like a funny little, like, slightly surreal joke that doesn't belong in this otherwise relatively grounded film. Like, it doesn't feel like it feels Anchorman-y. It doesn't feel like this, you know? Mm-hmm. It just all felt like it was just falling short of the line, you know, or just like clanging into the net a bit too often and more than it should have done. It's not bad. But it's like you went to go and see tennis and instead someone's playing pickleball. That's probably the best way I can kind of put it.
Yeah. I thought this was perfectly fine. I will say that this is another film that gets across how tricky it is to get sports right on film. Obviously, when it comes to tennis, challenges is the gold standard, and this falls well short of that, to put it mildly. But I had a perfectly okay time with this. I think Jake Johnson has really great comedic timing. We see that a lot. Ed Harris gets a lot of laughs out of playing things completely straight. That made me laugh quite a bit. Aaron Chen plays PJ, who is Dusty's loyal friend. He's kind of funny, loyal, and weird all in one. And that kind of worked for me. So, yeah, I had a perfectly pleasant time with this.
It's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
It is the most low 3-star movie that has ever low 3-starred.
Yeah, it's low stakes fun.
I think I could go to 3 on this. Like, I'm saying that as I say that, I'm thinking about it. I do think it's a 3 and not a 2. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's not a high 3. It's not close to a 4. It's close to a 2.
Yeah.
But
I agree with that.
I do feel a 2 would be mean.
Yes.
Okay.
No, I'm fully with you on 3 stars.
Yeah. So there we go. So that's
3 stars. Woohoo! We have a winner!
That's on Apple, and by process of elimination is our film of the week.
Hooray!
But realistically, genuinely and honestly and truly, you should just go see The Odyssey again. Yeah. I'm not being paid by Chris Nolan to say this, although he could afford it. Chris, call me. No. Oh,
just no.
Or The Invite is probably still on, or Nirvana, the band, the show, the
or
movie.
Or rewatch Dune's Part 1 and 2 in advance of Dune Part 3.
Nobody has said a single word against Dune. It doesn't need to be defended.
I sense your Dune prejudice.
Or watch Batman the Animated Series, Feet of Clay. Great episode.
I mean, we've got ages before Clay first comes out.
Also, that's more the domain of the Pilot TV podcast.
Oh, so, God. You know. All right. Well, that is it, isn't it, for this week's Empire podcast. Join us next week when we're going to be joined by probably, I believe, Destin Daniel Cretton to talk about Spider-Man Brand New Day and to celebrate the fact that another honest-to-God film is coming to our cinemas. Guys, I cannot tell you how long it's been since I saw a film with real stars in cinemas. I mean, like, imagine seeing Zendaya on the big screen. Do you know what I mean? Imagine seeing Tom Holland on the big screen.
Imagine seeing John Bergle on the big screen.
Right? I mean, how long has it been since we've seen those people? It's going to be such a relief. Oh, thank God. Anyway, until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it's goodbye from Amon.
Peace.
Goodbye from James.
Goodbye. Do you listen to the Pilot TV podcast on Monday, where you will hear Steph go absolutely berserk against a show? I have never heard anyone hate anything more than she hated one of the shows that we review on Monday.
So,
wow. Look forward to that.
Exciting. I'm going to ask you what that was as soon as we put the mics down. And it's goodbye from me. I am genuinely off to see The Oresteia at the Bridge Theatre, which is, of course, about Agamemnon's homecoming from the Trojan Wars. Because these days...
Oh, Helen.
I'm Odyssey maxing.
Oh, my God, you really are.
I'm sorry. I'm obsessed.
Oh, God.
Toodaloo.